It's hot, girls, so take it off. Take it all off. 'Cause here comes the Colonel.
Oh my God, where did she come from? This is a science program. The burlesque auditions are down the hall, the third door on your left. Get out of here. Oh, that's characters that come through this place. That's what happens, I guess, when you share a studio with a number of other production companies. Well, welcome back. The second half of The Promise of Tomorrow. You're on the Science News Radio Network, exploring the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, and all kinds of characters. I'm your host. I'm Colonel Mason. In just a minute, we're going to get back to our interview with today's guest, our dear friend, Dr. Dashuan Feng, who is Vice President of National Tsinghua University in Taiwan. That's the top university in Taiwan, and also the sister university of Tsinghua University, the top university in mainland China, in Beijing. They share 100 years of roots and aspirations, an unbelievable platform for those two great universities on both shores. So, we're going to get back to that. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set and dig around in our coin jar here, because we got to make some contributions to the fountain. And we'll throw in some coins and see about today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
Aha, I see, with the proper coins, we have summoned the spirit of the fountain. All right, oh, spirit of the fountain, here's a nice science question for you. What planet did Mariner 4 broadcast close-up pictures of in July of 1965? Mariner 4, July 1965, what planet did the Mariner broadcast close-up pictures of?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell.
Oh, well, the spirit of the fountain has the answer. From way back in 1965, Mariner 4 broadcast close-up pictures of the planet Mars. All right, now back to our program. So, when we broke at the half hour, today's guest, Dr. Dashuan Feng, Vice President of National Tsinghua University in Taiwan, was explaining to us about how all the nations of Asia-Pacific are coming together to form one big powerhouse economic trade zone. So it isn't just China, the great economic leader that we've seen. We've got a whole free trade zone as a big economic powerhouse. Now, one quick question, though. Now, where does this leave North Korea? They're out in the cold on this, right?
Well, North Korea at the moment, I have no idea what will happen, but I think that it's beginning to show very clearly that South Korea's economic power is beginning to penetrate deeply into North Korea. China's economic power is beginning to deeply. For example, in Pyongyang, my understanding is more and more South Korean and mainland Chinese companies are actually setting up shops there.
Really?
So you can see that given another 10, 15 years, or maybe sooner, because things could change very quickly there, I think South and North Korea will come to some kind of amalgamation. In what form, I don't know, whether it will be like the East and West Germany or not. But I think this too will melt in time.
Wow, that's some fascinating stuff, Dr. Feng. And in fact, as we hear reports all the time of people leaving North Korea and going to work in South Korea and taking the long way around through Cambodia and those sorts of things.
That's right. So, anyway, that's the economic defragmentation. But now, if I ask you, how could geographical defragmentation happen? Because you know that Indonesia has 13,000 islands.
Mm-hmm.
Philippines has 7,000 islands. Thailand has about 3,000 or 4,000 islands. And Malaysia has about 1,000 islands. You say, well, I mean, islands don't move. They cannot join together. But let me tell you what is happening from a point of view of transportation.
Okay.
By 2020, there will be high-speed rail from China through Laos, through Thailand, through Malaysia, all the way to Singapore.
Wow.
So that's already underway in the construction. Now, recently, as you all know, that there were some accidents of high-speed rail, which was very unfortunate, and there were loss of life.
Mm-hmm.
But in some sense, that is a blessing, somewhat blessing in disguise, only in the sense that what that means is they'll have to perfect the system. And as you all know, any time you have real technologies of such a massive scale, including our shuttles, for example, you will have accidents. And accidents are generally happen because the design was not as good as it could be.
Yeah.
So China actually is now slowing down its entire nation's high-speed rail, not slowing down the construction, but slowing down the speed so that they want to make sure that things are getting better. What I'm trying to say here is the whole construction of high-speed rail is going to continue. It will not be stopped. Now, by 2020, you can actually take a high-speed rail from the northernmost border of China near the Russian border all the way to Singapore by a high-speed rail. That, to me, is a defragmentization. But that doesn't end there. Now, I don't know whether you have seen the recent CNN interview of Indonesia's president.
No.
This gentleman came on in year 2004, has literally transformed Indonesia onto a road of becoming a modern country. And one of the areas that he is also talking about is to significantly construct and transform the infrastructure of Indonesia. The most amazing thing that is happening at the moment is that Indonesia and Malaysia finally realized that between Malacca and one of Indonesia's large island called Sumatra. Do you know that?
Yes, I know Sumatra, and I'm aware that Indonesia is largely Islamic. Isn't that correct? And how does that jive with the religions of the rest of this Asia Pacific you're talking about?
Yeah, we'll get to the religion a little later, okay?
Okay, sure.
The Indonesia and in the Malaysia has this Malacca and Sumatra.
Mm-hmm.
Malaysia and Sumatra is separated by the Malacca Straits, which is open sea.
Mm-hmm.
At the closest point, it's only 38 kilometers. And so Indonesia and Malaysia are now designing an underwater tunnel.
Oh, really?
Now, you might say the 38 kilometers is a long way.
Yeah.
But remember, the German and French connection between Paris and London, the underwater sea,
yeah,
was 51 kilometers.
Oh, really?
So, therefore, this is even shorter. So, okay. Technologically, this can be done. So, can you imagine now, once that happened, then you can go from Northern Asia all the way down to Malaysia, underground, they go through the underwater tunnel, and all the way from Sumatra, down to, all the way to Java, into Jakarta, and to the eastern part of Java.
But Dr. Feng, I have to ask you: is this going to be safe? I mean, we've had a tsunami over there not too long ago. I'm not talking about the Japanese tsunami. I'm talking about the one in Indonesia, and that's because of underwater faults. So what's going to happen to the tunnel in an unsafe area like that?
I think these are technological questions that can be solved.
Okay.
People, good engineers, can solve these problems.
Okay.
I have full confidence that modern technology can handle all these kind of problems when they come about. Besides, the link between Malacca and Sumatra is far away from the fault line. The fault line is at the northern part of Sumatra. By the way, Sumatra is a very, very long island.
Yeah.
From the tip of Sumatra north to the southern part of Sumatra is 2,000 miles.
Oh, jeez.
It's a long way.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is a long way from the northern tip of the Sumatra island. Mm. In fact, during the last earthquake, the middle part to southern part of Sumatra was hardly touched.
That's interesting, much to know. So the connection, you think, can be made by engineering?
Let me get back to the question of the Islamic.
Okay.
Indonesia's Islamic. I think that we will have to recognize, and I think that the United States must recognize, Islamic does not mean that necessarily they cannot work with people. Only the ultra-fundamental Islamic cannot work with people, just like the ultimate fundamental Christians cannot work with people. That we will have to just take it as given.
Mm.
But I think that with the rise of the middle class in Indonesia, which it is now rising rather rapidly, and if you go to Malaysia, you will also see the rise of the middle class Malays. More and more Malays are now, on the one hand, being Islamic. On the other hand, they're also understanding what the real world entails, real world being the modern world, and not real, but modern world entails. There is major transformation of all this. I think that one cannot associate the ultra conservative Islamic people, such as the Al-Qaeda, with the Islamic people of Indonesia and Malaysia. They're very, very different. And also, the recognition, because Southeast Asia have a huge number of multiracial complexion, unlike that of Iraq and the Middle East. Singapore, well, Malaysia, for example, has 27% Chinese. And Indonesia has something like 20 million Chinese. So all this has a lot of moderating effect in the region. And especially now with China's growing influence in the entire region, I think that with the geographical defragmentization in the next 10 to 20 years, culture, religion, history, politics will all go through some fundamental transformation, something that we have never seen before in Asia. So that's why I say that this is to be in the midst of all this in building higher education, such as Tsinghua University in Beijing and Tsinghua University in Taiwan, is truly, truly an exciting time to be.
Not only that, but you visited the University of Malaysia, their delegation recently, I think, didn't you?
We're going. In fact, Malaysia has just sent a big delegation here. They're going. University of Malaya has sent a very. By the way, the president of the University of Malaya, his name is Gulf Jasmine.
Mm-hmm.
He's a Muslim, but he is an incredible person, broad view, visionary, full of excitement, and can speak in any way with. And highly, highly educated. He has his PhD from Imperial College in London. So, you know, there are more of such people happening all over Southeast Asia. And I think it's very exciting time.
And this religious strife that we've been talking about that has affected Indonesia and other places like that, and in reaction to that rapid growth, you think is going to be contained?
I'm going to lead, my president and I are going to try to lead a team to visit University of Indonesia and the Bandung Institute of Technology. Bandung Institute of Technology is what Indonesia wanted to become, the MIT of Indonesia, and Bandung, University of Indonesia, is what they want to make it to become the Harvard of Indonesia.
All right, so you're going to try to sew that all together, and you're going to give us some reports on how that's going along?
Absolutely. So all these things are happening.
All these things are happening, and an exciting thing that's going on is the defragmentation. Is that what you called it, the defragmentation in Asia?
That's right, defragmentation of Asia.
Wow. Fascinating prediction, Dr. Feng. So good to talk to you again. How's the weather there in Taiwan?
Well, right now it's sunny and hot. But we have a, just like you guys, we have a tornado, not a tornado, what we have a typhoon.
Mm-hmm.
And what do you call it? In
we call it a hurricane here.
Hurricane, yeah, you call it hurricane. We have a typhoon probably coming in the next 48 hours, and you have a big one that's coming up the coast.
Yeah, Irene, as a matter of fact.
Right, right. So we have something. Oh, by the way, just one more small thing. Just 2 days ago, which is August 23rd, we were at the Quemoy Island. Do you remember the Quemoy Island?
Oh, yes, of course I remember Quemoy and Matsu. I remember Richard Nixon and John Kennedy, when they were both running for president back in 1960, got into a heated argument over whether we were going to defend Quemoy and Matsu, or if we weren't. It seems to me that Nixon said, yeah, he'd go to war over it, and Kennedy was saying, no, they're not worth it. Anyway, fill us in on that, if you would.
So, under the jurisdiction of the Republic of China,
okay,
and it is only 1.6 kilometers away from mainland China, and the first phase of a bridge between Quemoy and one of the small island, which also belongs to the Republic of China, is being constructed. And very soon, within the next decade, there could be a bridge that's going to link Quemoy with the mainland. And so imagine, on 1958, August 23rd, China fired 40,000 shells to Quemoy. Today, we're building a bridge from Quemoy to the mainland.
Isn't that interesting? And that old argument of John Kennedy and Richard Nixon back in 1960 was for nothing.
Right. By the way, you should, if you have a chance, go onto Google and look at that debate. During that debate, Quemoy and Matsu was mentioned 16 times.
Oh.
And the Berlin conflict, the other hotspot of the Cold War at that point, was only mentioned 10 times. So Quemoy became world-renowned. In fact, I have worked very closely with people in the Quemoy in the last 4 years. They have now set up the National Quemoy University.
Now, is Quemoy in the strait there between Taiwan and the mainland?
It's in the strait only in the sense that it is actually very, very, very close to the mainland.
Okay.
It's 1.6 kilometers.
It's amazing there would have been a disagreement over that between two presidential candidates in the first place. One would suppose that it always belonged to China.
Because at that point, I don't know whether you read it, actually, Kennedy was actually willing to give up Quemoy,
yeah,
for the communists.
Yeah.
What Kennedy said was that the agreement between the United States and the Republic of China with Chiang Kai-shek was to protect the island of Taiwan and the so-called Pescadore Islands, which is a bunch of islands that is close to the Taiwan island.
Mm-hmm.
He said that we did not agree on protecting the Quemoy Island, which is too close to mainland. In his mind, I assume, is because that's not protectable since it's so close. And Nixon actually said that from his point of view, the Quemoy Island is absolutely the front line against the communists. So he said we must defend Quemoy. So that's the argument during that period.
And what's interesting is it's probably an outgrowth of the Truman Doctrine from the 1940s, when Truman said that we were going to meet communism wherever it occurred anywhere in the world.
Here's a very interesting sideline.
Mm-hmm.
Quemoy, by the way, in Chinese, means Golden Gate.
Oh.
Now, if you think about it, the United States built a Golden Gate Bridge in the 20th century.
Sure.
Now, what does the Golden Gate Bridge tell you? Golden Gate Bridge tell you the rise of United States as an economic and intellectual power in the 20th century, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if there is a bridge in Asia, which is also somehow, because of the history,
yeah,
it's also called the Golden Gate Bridge, Quemoy Island, Quemoy Bridge.
Okay.
Then it could mean that the Golden Gate Bridge of the 21st century may signify the rise of economic and intellectual power of Asia.
What a profound thought, Dr. Feng.
Now, I would always say that one should never think that United States is on its last leg.
Okay.
One of the greatest strengths of United States ever since it became a nation is that it welcomed people. It welcomed people from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
It brought in people from everywhere to think differently, to act differently, and to think innovatively. And I hope that United States will never allow itself to become a closed-door, isolated nation.
Well, on that encouraging word, this program comes to an end. Our thanks to our dear friend, Dr. Dashuan Feng, Vice President of National Tsinghua University, the top university in Taiwan, and Dr. Feng speaking to us from his home in Hsinchu, Taiwan.
And now, we make time for the Voice of Reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
I think it's a case of really, we lost our common sense for a number of years. I think it's a pervading trait within the Western world, where we've developed service-based economies. We've allowed the rundown of the industrial complexes, and we need to redress that balance. And the beauty of the situation is that nanoscience gives us the opportunity to do that. It gives us the opportunity to build an entire manufacturing based on the use of precision materials and so forth, and the U.S., for example, will be a dominant player in that field, undoubtedly, as indeed will Europe. I think in relation to Ireland personally, I think we've got to carry it away with the idea of cheap money, and we've basically now had to turn around and pay the piper, as it were, you know. It's been a humbling, but the old saying in Ireland is we've seen worse times than that, and we'll get over it, you know. I think that for 10 years we went on a spend craze, and we're not out of the woods yet by any means, particularly in the European Union and for example in the United States they're discussing the debt situation at the moment. But at the end of the day, if we recognize what our problems are, we can deal with them. But I think that there's a long way to go before our respective political leaders of rough and metal to actually be able to tackle these problems. They're structural problems that have been on the cards since the 1970s. For example, I speak to colleagues in the United States, and they talk about the running down of hitherto industrial complexes within the United States, and I find that very sad. But I do recognize, and I'm seeing of late, that the U.S. corporations are rallying to the flag, and the jobs are starting to come home to the United States of America, because the recognition is quite something it is, that you cannot trade jobs for profit indefinitely. Sooner or later, you're going to have to strike a balance. And I think that's what we did. We all did that. We traded jobs for profit, and we traded for the quick buck. And, you've had corporations that took decades to build that have been whittled away through spin-outs and takeovers and God knows what. And it wasn't sustainable and isn't sustainable. And anybody who comes from an economic background knows that a service economy isn't sustainable because it's dependent on the availability of credit. I mean, we only got to sit down and look back at the role our parents used to say, that our parents, they never borrowed anything. When they wanted to buy a car, they saved up for it. And, I probably think our generation, and maybe the younger generation coming forward, we just need to be a little bit more prudent and have more common sense with it. Charles McGovern, Inks Exchange.
So you decide, has this really been the Voice of Reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.